With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi, Roger, it's Brian. Look, mate, an unbelievable opportunity has presented itself for us. We've been asked to speak to a lot of people at the Podcast Stop Festival at the Kentish Town Forum on February the 13th, 2021 at 2 p.m. I'll be there. I think you should too. Okay, cheers, Rog. Bye.
Hello, Brian. It's Roger here. So that's the Podcast Stop Festival at Kentish Town Forum at 2 p.m. on Saturday, February the 13th, 2021. To speak to a lot of people. Okay, mate, well, that sounds like it'll be loads of fun, and I really can't see anything going wrong at all. Okay, mate, see you there. Bye-bye.
Brian and Roger, live at the O2 Forum Kentish Town for the Podcast Stop Festival on Saturday the 13th of February. Tickets are available at livenation.co.uk and ticketmaster.co.uk.
The following podcast is a member of the Great Big Owl family.
This will certainly have an adult theme and might well contain strong scenes of sex or violence, which could be quite graphic. It may also contain some very explicit language, which will frequently mean sexual swear words.
What do you like listening to?
Chart music.
Chart music.
You pop craze youngsters, and welcome to the latest episode of Chart Music, the podcast that gets its hand right down the back of the sofa on a random episode of Top of the Pops. I'm your host, Al Needham, and by my side today are my colleagues, Neil Kulkarni.
Hello there.
And rock expert, David Stubbs.
How do you do?
David, before we start, just tell the world why you are known as rock expert, David Stubbs.
The rock expert, yeah. It goes back to November the 22nd, or 23rd, I should say, of 1997. Yeah. Early on Sunday morning, this would have been. I just got this call from a geezer called Barry, who worked at the Observer. Oh, fuck, what's this about? You know, and I was pretty woozy. You know, I'd had a skinful, as per, and, you know, my head was a bit fuzzy. And he just sort of said, and, they've just found out Michael Hutchins, In Excess, he's died. I was like, we need some sort of, like, background, some context. We're putting the items to bed, you know, we're putting the piece to bed now, and obviously, you know, for the Sunday edition. What do you know about Michael Hutchins? Said, yeah, what do you know? I mean, like, you know, do you know, was he, you know, what kind of animal was, what kind of rock and roll animal? Did he, you know, did he drink a lot? Did he do a lot of drugs? Drugs? I don't know, not as far as I know, you know. Fuck all about In Excess. So the next morning, you know, and I forget the call has even existed. The next morning, I go out and get the Observer, and there it is on the fucking front page. Rock expert David Stubbs says Michael Hutchins never took drugs. Oh my fucking God. So, well, don't worry, nobody will notice. Everybody notice. Everybody reads the fucking Observer, it turns out. You know, it's like Kramer's lawyer in Seinfeld. This is the worst year of my many humiliations. It's stuck ever since, but what can you do? I really enjoyed that little excerpt. I mean, I think that what's nice about it is, I mean, as Neil will testify, getting a good copy out of Ozzy Osbourne is kind of like getting the blood out of a stone, you know, and I really got him to talk a bit there, you know, as I think that's my brilliant interviewing, laid-back interviewing technique, I think.
You know. Turkeys and vultures, man.
Yeah.
You crack that open, man.
I'll have to send you my interview with Ginger Baker, actually, for the next rock excerpt, David Stubbs. Yeah, that's a little bit less loquacious, put it that way.
See, because I listened to that all the way through when I was researching the Black Sabbath for the last episode, and I'm just sitting there listening to it, going, "Oh, I know him; he's my mate."
But it just reminded me of the absolute fucking mundane shit you come out with when you interview people. Obviously just immediately gets cut, but that's the goal.
Yeah.
Who knew that Ozzy Osbourne sat down with his family with some Linda McCartney sausages?
That's what people really want to know.
Yeah.
Yes, anyway, that's why I am rock expert David Stubbs.
And you forevermore you shall be, Dave.
Good.
Anyway, the pop and the interesting things that have occurred of late. There must be loads of them.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's been really dramatic of late, hasn't it?
Yes.
Well, I mean, can I just use this as usual, not to say anything pop and interesting, and just use it as a kind of confessional booth, really? Not confessional booth. You know, I don't speak to adults anymore. So chart music is my sole chance to speak to adults instead of my bloody kids. So let me just have a moan. I've got a wasp's nest, right?
Yeah, man.
And it's been here since summer. I looked at a pest controller, but then I had that usual paroxysm of how much? Because it was going to be like £100. Bought some powder, which kind of worked, but I think they're starting to develop a taste for it now. And cold frosts can't kill them. What's going on? It's this wasp's nest that just won't die. I'm almost proud of them, but I'm also cognizant if a new weather-resistant kind of winter wasp is possible, then is the future worth proceeding with?
And
they crawl into the house to die. It's like that Civil War scene in Gone with the Wind, but with fucking Jasper bastards at the moment. So there's that going on. I'm also among the non-furloughed, looking at the furloughed with envy and wonder. And I'd feel remiss if I didn't express solidarity with my teaching brethren, if I didn't say, fucking hell, what happened to all those long holidays I used to read about in the Daily Mail about teachers? That's just not happened this year. And things have got so desperate that the other week I downloaded a meditation app. So,
oh God,
I know, it's a rocky road. If the next time I come on Chart Music, I just say stuff like, hey guys, it's time you took a long soak in Lake U, then it's, it's time for an intervention at that point. And you're going to need to drag me to a cabin or something. But I am teaching about interesting stuff. I'm teaching music history, basically. So my weekends are spent listening to things like Duke Ellington and Louis Armstrong. I cannot moan about that. I was teaching about Alan Freed this week. And, just fantasise. That time travel thing. You know, when you look at a picture of Duke Ellington at the Savoy in the 30s, or you look at the bill for an Alan Freed rock and roll roadshow, you do just start dreaming about time travel and what you'd go back to. I think, musically, if I could just choose one, I would go see an Alan Freed rock and roll roadshow from the mid-50s, because the bills are just nuts. It's like Chuck Berry, Little Richard, just... You know, and you can tell they're not going to hang around doing fucking solos. It's going to be like 10 minutes on and then they're off. That would be my dream, absolute dream time travel in musical terms. We'll be back to the 50s to see an Alan Freed rock and roll roadshow. But who knows how segregation would work with an Asian? Where do we fit in all of that? Yeah, anyway, that's what I've been doing mainly.
What's this thing about goodness gracious me that popped up on your feed? You've got to tell the pop craze youngsters about this.
Oh, that's brilliant. Yeah.
Yeah, it's bizarre that. Yeah, sorry, that completely slipped my mind out. But yeah, years and years and years ago.
Wait till you hear this, pop craze youngsters.
Years and years and years ago. I mean, I loved Goodness Gracious Me, of course. Virtually the entire Asian community in this country loved seeing ourselves on the screen. And
come on, man. You had to take off up, Mum.
What do you want? And mind your language. No, you're right. You're absolutely right. But goodness gracious me, I just remember there was a sketch in about 97, I think. And it was this song called Hindi People. It was obviously a takeoff of Pulp's Common People. And it was about kind of cultural tourism, really. It was about sort of white people who want to pretend to be Asian and have a bindi on and wear a sari and all that sort of stuff. Mm. A couple of lines really jumped out at me. For starters, there's a line about studying at the University of York. Now, I studied at the University of York. There's a moment where he throws away a Kula Shaker record. And I'm not saying I'm famous for dissing Kula Shaker, but certainly, you know, people knew I hated that band. And then the whole song ends with the line, "You'll never get with me because I was born in Coventry." And I remember watching this in 97 and thinking, fuck, that's uncanny. And then thinking, do they know me? Do they, you know, but you don't know. I was a kid in Cov who occasionally commuted out of London. And this is pre-internet. There's no way of checking this stuff. So for 20, 30, you know, well, actually, no. For 20 odd years, I've wondered, was that about me?
Your ears were burning.
Yeah. It's too uncanny, do you know what I mean? Especially the throwing away of the Cooler Shaker record and the thing from Coventry, studying at the University of York. It was just too much of a coincidence. So, I mean, the sole benefit, I guess, I've discovered of the open sewer that is Twitter is that you're able to kind of get in touch with people. So I got in touch with Sanjeev Bhaskar, or rather I posted the video, Hindi People, and just suggested, I've always wondered whether this is about me. And yeah, he got back. We always knew it was about you. I mean, that's mad, isn't it?
That is, fucking hell.
I mean, it's really strange. I mean, it's lovely as well. But it's a kind of ambiguous statement, the thing he said back. We always knew it was about you. Does that mean it was about me? I can't tell. But I mean, that's too many coincidences, isn't it?
No, claim it, Neil.
I am going to claim it. Which amazes me. Because, you know, when you write for the music press, especially in the 90s, the only feedback you got was in backlash, you know, occasionally on the letters page. Mm. You get somebody, you know, writing it, usually to slack you off. So this notion that somebody outside of that tiny music press readership was cognizant of me in the 90s, to the point where they got a sketch on national television... not based on my life as such, but certainly, you know, that's me. Yeah. It's mad. I still can't wrap my head around that.
There's one possible connection here. You know, I suspect, to be honest, they just directly, you know, knew about you just from reading Meldenberger. But I did,
perhaps, yeah,
was kind of like vaguely friends and went out for a drink a few times with a guy called Sharat Sadana, who was one of the writers and occasionally appeared on the show, on Goodness Gracious Me. Mm. In fact, he was the guy who co-wrote the Going for an English sketch,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, where, you know, if you remember that one. Mm. Yeah, when, you know, you even tried to sort of get, you know, work for the BBC at the time and even tried and failed, mainly because I didn't come up with any good ideas, to try and get some sort of, you know, sitcom type thing that I might sort of do. But didn't really come to anything.
Gammon and spinach is still going, David.
Sadly, he died when he was about 40. He died quite a few years ago. But so it might, that might have like facilitated the connection. But I suspect they just read The Maker. I suspect they were aware of you.
That's the bizarre thing, because like, you know, the stars of New Asian Cool, who I always had a tangential relationship to anyway, like Bobby Friction is my friend now. And he said to me the other day, yeah, I used to read your stuff all the time. We knew about you. Everyone knew about you. That staggers me, you know. But it's lovely to hear. It is lovely to hear. And I guess, you know, what I've repeatedly said on Chart Music is, you know, there's not been any Asian people on Top of the Pops, and Freddie Mercury didn't admit to being Asian. We just wanted to see something. I guess for some Asian people, at least in the 90s, having an Asian writer in the music press did mean something and did matter, and they did kind of pay attention, which, I mean, it blows my mind. It really does.
Yeah.
David,
mm.
Your book, where is it? I want
it
now.
Oh, yeah, yes. Well, I mean, there's more work to be done on it, but I did have this kind of like Stephen King sort of like write the last paragraph type moment. And like,
have you even told people what it's about yet, David?
Yeah, well, it's a history of British comedy. Now, I did on Facebook suggest I did write up, you know, as a kind of sneak preview, the last two or three paragraphs, which, you know, perhaps I can read for you now here as a, you know, as a heads up for the pop craze youngsters.
Yeah, indeed.
So it's as
shall I set it to some music?
Yes, do. Yeah. Something stirring.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I thought something a bit jaunty and, you know, comedy.
Well, I don't know. I mean, well, put it this way. The working title is We Laughed Away Mr. Hitler, We Laughed Away Mr. Scargill, A History of British Comedy. So, you know, take it from there. Anyway, as follows. Well, I hope you've enjoyed the story of British comedy. If we've learned one thing, it's that we Brits love to laugh. If you've not had a laugh before, why not try out some of the comedians and shows mentioned in this book? You'll find examples of their work on channels like UK Gold, YouTube, or special digital versatile disc editions. Warning, be sure to be sitting near an aisle when you watch them, because pretty soon you'll be rolling. Of course, there were all kinds of things you used to be able to laugh at, you know, get fun from, before Mr. Ben Elton came along. I hope you'll find some good examples here of the way things were when you were used to be allowed to smile. Scenes like Goodness Gracious, I'm a Foreigner, George the Stammering Half-Wit, Nancy Boy About the House, and My Wife the Nazi. If there's one thing I'd like you to take away, no, not a curry, you can't mention them anymore, is that we British have the unique ability to poke fun at yourselves. You know, women, whoopsies, northerners and the like. Let's hope that now that we have a true comedian in charge of the country and don't have to send our scripts to Belgian bureaucrats for approval anymore, we can get back to those gay days when gay meant what Larry Grayson meant it to mean, not its current meaning. There you go.
Stirring stuff.
Now, all I can say is that, you know, it's a process, and it could be that that working title is, you know, dispensed with for politically correct reasons, and those paragraphs don't even appear in the book. But anyway, yeah, it's all done, and, well, not all done, but it's kind of first draft's finished, put it that way.
Oh, bravo, wow. David.
Thank you.
Well done. When's it due out?
Oh, I don't know. Probably not for about many months, to be honest. Oh. Yeah, there's a bit of a backlog at Faber.
Can I just ask, David? Obviously our list doesn't have to be included because I'm curious, basically. Have you got a cut-off date for this story in a sense that, like, you stop writing about comedy from perhaps, like, a couple of years ago? Is there like, do you stop in the 90s or noughties?
I do kind of cut off because, yeah. I mean, you know, not seriously, you know, the idea is in fact, political correctness is kind of a hero of the book. I'm saying that, like, that the kind of inclusivity and diversity of contemporary comedy, whether it's Man Like the Bean and stuff like that, or Derry Hills, mm-hmm. all this kind of stuff, you know, where there's just much broader representation, a much more a naturalistic sense of people's lives as actually lived, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It, you know, it's more realistic than the kind of speculative ideas of, like, white sitcom script writers in the 60s and 70s, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Pakistan is doing black people, et cetera, et cetera. That's the major... But what I've kind of said is, rather than go in depth into those series, I don't want to be the kind of the mansplaining guy in it and saying that, like, it's probably for somebody else to take up particular thing. And also, that's a history that's still being written, you know, with a lot of these series. They're midway through. So I suppose I kind of cut off... Yeah, about a few years ago, and then just allude to the way that things are in the present day.
Nothing to report from me, just doing chart music. So that's my life now.
What?
And the reason for that is because of the following people. You know who they are. They're the people who we stop, we drop, and we bow the knee to. Yes, they're the latest batch of pop-crazed youngsters who have put a jingle in our G-string this month. And those people are, in the $5 section, Ted Rogers, ooh, Clive Gash, Mark Meadowcroft, Tom Bradley, Douglas Hartley, Tommy D, Joseph Nawaz, Scott Brooks, Fred Loosley, Justin Thomas, Peeps Nibbles, Jake Anthony Ede, Dominic Ellison, Neil Mallon, Stuart Dade, Joseph Goss, Dave Caffrey, Sam Verall, Victoria Clester, Cormac Ward, Anthony Chapman, and Thunder Slave Parcel Force.
Brilliant.
Fine people, all.
In the $3 section, we have the Castello Kid and Paul Condon. Oh, former leader of the Metropolitan Police has given us $3. Thank you, Paul. Oh, and Vic Summers, thank you so much for jacking your donation up. And a special massive tar to Doug Grant, who's kicked in some dollar for a serious drink for everyone at Chart Music this Christmas time. Aww. Yes, boys, aww, there is a Santa, and his name is Doug. Thanks to all of you.
You are a gentleman, Doug.
Yes, you're all gentlemen, apart from the ladies.
We shall glug at the expense of Doug. I think that's
let's not forget, Pulp Craze Youngsters, that if you are donating to Patreon, if you're in the $5 section, you've got the full episode right now without any advert rubbish. And if you're in the $3 section, you get the full episode without any adverts a couple of days later. You get to cram the whole lot into any orifice you choose.
Which, face it, is what you want.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Fuck it. No sitting about waiting for the next bit. Get it down you now, mate. And of course, the other thing those people get to do is they get to tinker and a tanker and a fiddle. And indeed, they get to have a faddle as well with the Chart Music Top 10. Here it is, boys. This is the Christmas Top 10. Ah. Fucking hell. Shall we have it?
Oh, yes.
Yes, we shall. Yes. Hit the fucking music. We've said goodbye to Fine Time Fontaine, The Treacherous Steph, Suicide featuring Donna, and Spiteful Armored Bollock, which means none up, five down, one no change, and four new entries. Down one place from number 9 to number 10, it's Dave D, Creeper, Twat and Cunt. Oh. Last week's number 6, this week's number 9. Oh, it's a 6 to 9 for Jeff Sex. It's a 6 place drop from number 2 to number 8 for Simon Price's arsehole material.
Oh, that's not fair.
Stuck fast in the number 7 slot, here comes Jism.
It's becoming the dark side of the moon, really.
New entry this week at number 6, 15 Hitlers.
Ooh.
Into the top 5 and down 2 places from number 3 to number 5, it's Bomber Dog.
Oh.
Last week's number 1 drops all the way down to number 4, C-Fax Data Blast. Into the top 3, and it's a new entry for rock expert David Stubbs.
Excellent. Oh,
straight on into the chart at number 2 for Panties, which means the highest new entry crashing into the chart at the top, and this year's Chart Music Christmas number 1, James Galway's Flute of VD.
Wow.
Oh, man, what a chart.
What a
fucking chart that is.
What a chart. I mean, Al, you know, disputing your previous comments about Panties, straight in at number 2.
Yeah.
I mean,
Panties go up.
Perhaps this could be used to
use Panties, no thanks.
No.
Not at Christmas, Neil.
Let me finish. Perhaps this could be used to actually, you know, get the original Panties back together.
Oh, you know what? I've spent so much time trying to find out who Panties were and what they sounded like. There's a lot of things I need to delete from my Google search history, put it that way. Where can I get Panties from 1978? I think a wave of optimism has taken over the chart music top 10. Spiteful Armor Bollock dropping out the chart, man. That's a bit previous, yeah, isn't it?
Yeah.
Got a feeling they're going to resurface in the new year.
Also, sorry, what happened to C-Fax Data Blast?
Drop down, mate, number 4.
That's a shock. That's a shock. As much as 15 Hitlers in with a bullet.
Yeah, what do 15 Hitlers sound like?
All I'm seeing is Lie Back. But
yes. Well, rock expert David Stubbs. I mean, obviously, they're lectures on vinyl, aren't they?
Mm.
Like, I can imagine rock expert David Stubbs issuing an EP containing a lecture on the origination and progression of the hard-loving woman who goes all night long.
Yes. Definitely a chin stroke of that one.
James Galway's Flute of VD. Obviously, the non-Aws have had their say there, haven't they?
Mm, yeah, definitely. And James Galway's Flute of VD, let's be honest, it's James Galway.
So, Pop Craze Youngsters, if you are not giving us money at the moment and you really want to, and let's face it, you really, really want to, you get them little fingers right now. You set them down upon your keyboard. You mash patreon.com/chartmusic and you pledge if you feel like it. There's no obligation, but it'd be nice, wouldn't it?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Your soul will feel better.
Yes.
Mm.
So, this episode, Pop Craze Youngsters, takes us all the way back to December the 23rd, 1982. And, well, if last episode was a banquet, this one's a bit more of a selection box, isn't it?
Yeah.
And not necessarily a Cadbury selection box either. Mm. It's one of them your mum gets from the pan shop. And she thinks you're too young to notice, but you do notice.
Well, frankly, it's barely even that. It's more like a dog shit with a lolly stick in it. It's not a great episode.
Yeah.
No, we were spoiled last episode, weren't we?
Very much so. Okay. Yeah.
If it's a chocolate box, there's a lot of coffee flavour.
This is more like my memories of Top of the Pops, really, in that, you know, it occasioned more thumbs down and kind of scowling than anything else.
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, it's the end of the first year of the Yellow Hurl era.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as we know, 1982, it's been a year of change and progression in both the charts and in Top of the Pops, for good and bad.
Mm.
And I feel this episode encapsulates the spirit of 1982 in oh so many ways.
It's the 1982 that people like me never tell you about.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, I'm rhapsodising about it, you know. You think, actually, yes, there was all of this going on. I mean, I remember, I would have been sort of like putting like together mixtapes and like DJing, whatever. And like, you know, in many ways to me, you know, 1982 represents an absolute crest for pop. You know, we're going to leap from 82 into 1983, and that was just going to be this glorious year.
Mm.
Africa was going to be free, a merman I should turn to be, and all that. It was just going to be, we were on this cusp of transformation. I think like something like Simple Minds promised you a miracle and all that kind of stuff. It was teetering on all of that, and it was tremendous promise. Michael Foot would be prime minister as well, you know, and finally be rid of Thatcherism, you know, just be a kind of just social transformation in going hand in glove with, you know, the kind of great pop aesthetic movements of the day. Yeah, and then, you know, I mean, it was a statistic that I read the other day. I was just looking at like, you know, percentage of youth vote for Conservatives. Now, in the 2019 election, it was 21% of 18 to 24-year-olds voted Conservative. Back in 1983, that number was around 42%.
Fuck. 42%
of young people, of 18 to 24-year-olds voted for Margaret Thatcher. Okay, and it's just like, God knows where all these people were. They weren't in my bubble. And I suppose I was in a bit of a bubble, you know, because I tried to associate with like minds. Although actually, when I come to think about it, they were hard to find. I was Oxford at the time. I was in my, just in the beginning of my second year. And now that I do think about it, you know, even something like Simple Minds was considered sort of ridiculously radical. You know, it's like, you know, putting Cabaret Voltaire or This Heat on, you know, was Simple Minds as far as a lot of contemporaries were concerned. There probably was a lot more sort of conservatism around at the time. And in a sense, I'm not saying that, like, you know, all the kind of some of the duffers that are on this, you know, episode tonight voted Tory, but, well, certainly not one of them in particular. But yeah, there was a distinct underside to 1982. And I think, as Al says, yes, this does speak a truth about the year, which I probably wish it hadn't.
Yeah, if you want that truth about a year, the Christmas episodes are always good for that. Because they're purely, in a sense, about figures. Sales figures, I mean. So although during the year you're able to negotiate the year and avoid things that are rubbish in your radio choices and your listening, at Christmas, you get the big hits, and they're quite often pretty fucking awful, as we'll see.
Yeah, I mean, we've got to make this clear now, that this is not the Top of the Pops Christmas episode of 1983.
No.
It's the last proper Top of the Pops of 1982. But, you know, and the great thing about 1982 and this period is that, you know, by this time, in late 1982, the kids had finally wrested control of the charts, and Top of the Pops and Michael Hurl have been struggling to keep it a family show. But as we all know, December's always that month where the non-alls of Britain fumbled in their purses at the counter of HMV.
Yeah.
To the detriment of our weekly dose of pop excitement. We're going to see a lot of that in this one, aren't we?
Yeah. You're absolutely right. Yeah.
We're going to see the damage that Grandma We Love You wrought.
Now, at this time, I wouldn't really watch much TV, but one thing we've done is congregate the Top of the Pops in the old Union Common Room. And yeah, it would have been the thing where you would have like sort of like give a cheer and a boo, you know, to things that were kind of our world and things that weren't really. And I just remember 1982 in general yielding a very high hit rate. You know, there might be, you know, if you were feeling generous, you might let Haircut 100 in or whatever, yeah, because Enemy wrote about them once, you know, things like that. But it was generally, you know, you might get 13 or 14 cheers out of an episode, you know.
I think you're absolutely right, Al. It's the grannies, isn't it? It's them going to the record shops. Yeah. And possibly picking out what they think might be good gifts for their grandchildren.
There's a prime example of that, isn't there?
Yeah.
Mm. Oh, God, gotcha. Come on, let's get stuck in.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, I'm Justin.
And I'm Lucy.
And together we are the hosts of Plenty Questions.
It's a very straightforward general knowledge quiz.
We ask you 20 questions, one after the other, 5 second gap in between, and you shout the answers out.
And then you tweet us to let us know how you've got on.
See if you can get 20 out of 20. No one has so far, but that's because we haven't started doing it yet.
But we will. And there's also going to be some fiendish brain teasers, so join us for Plenty Questions.
In the news this week, well, the USA announced that their first batch of cruise missiles are fully operational and have started leaning hard on the Thatcher government to get them installed at Greenham Common before the CND movement gains momentum in the UK. Meanwhile, women from the Greenham Common Peace Camp have infiltrated the base's Saturday night disco, have danced with assorted GIs, and reminded them that they're living on a prime target for Soviet nuclear missiles. According to The Guardian, one of the disco raiders said, "When they found out we were from the peace camp, one of them buried his head in his hands and said, 'Jesus Christ.'" They seem friendly, but seems scared the officers would discover who we were. Fucking hell, that's a play for today right there, isn't it? Freedom common people, if you will.
Very good.
Turkeys have been withdrawn from sale in Harrods and a Woolworths in Liverpool after an anonymous phone call from someone posing as a member of the animal rights activist group claimed that they'd been laced with paraquat. Police later announced it's a hoax. Margaret Thatcher has invited a special guest to stay with her at Chequers for the entire duration of the Christmas holiday, Jimmy Savile. In an interview with Gloria Hunniford, Savile says he can't wait to have a break from being Britain's most prolific sex offender for a while, but will be nipping out to the nearby Stoke Mandeville Hospital to give out sweets to poorly kids at some point in the week. Keith Richards has got married to Patty Hansen in Barbados. Sweaty paedophile minor royal Prince Andrew has been discovered building a love nest around the corner of Buckingham Palace with the actress Koo Stark.
Ooh.
The BBC have announced the presenters for their forthcoming breakfast TV slot, which starts next month. Frank Boff and shaking Diana herself, Selena Scott. Tottenham Hotspur have announced the imminent return of Osvaldo Ardiles from his spell at Paris Saint-Germain, who he moved to in the wake of the Falklands War. But the big news this week is that Smash Hits have just announced the results of the 1982 Reader's Poll. Shall we play a game, chaps?
Oh, yes, please.
Oh, God, I'm always rubbish at these, but go on, yeah.
Best band?
82.
For 82.
Got to be Duran.
Yeah, I'm going to say Duran.
Duran Duran.
Yeah.
Best male singer?
Well, Simon Le Bon.
Yeah, I'm going to go Simon Le Bon too.
Simon Le Bon.
Yeah, I mean, how would it not be?
Best female singer?
Oh. It's going to be something like Tracy Ullman or something, isn't it?
I think it's either Claire Grogan or it might be Annie Lennox. I'm going to go Claire Grogan.
It's too early for Annie Lennox.
Oh, God, yeah, it's too early.
Toya.
Toya, yeah, of course.
Fucking hell.
Side out.
Best single.
Oh, well, what was 1982? Was it there was a Reflex that year?
No, that was 83, wasn't it?
it wouldn't have been anything good. It's not going to be bloody Scritti Flitti or whatever like it should have been. something by Duran Duran.
Yeah, because, I mean, Rio comes out in 82, doesn't it? So I'm going to go for the title track. Fuck it, Rio.
Save a Prayer.
Okay.
Best LP.
Okay, I'm going to go Rio, Duran Duran.
Yeah, me too.
Rio, Duran Duran.
Yeah.
Most promising new act.
Ooh. 82.
It wouldn't possibly be Bow Wow Wow, would it?
It's a duo.
Wham.
82. Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. They were just beginning to break at that point. I'm pretty sure.
Tears for Fears.
Oh, right.
Most annoying record. I'll give you a clue on this one. It wasn't a number one, but it was the follow-up to a number one.
Ooh. It's a good clue, Al, but I'm still none the wiser, to be honest with you.
Was it the follow-up?
Most?
St. Winifred's, whatever, followed that up. They did a follow-up to that, didn't they?
No.
Give up?
Yeah, I give up.
What by Captain Sensible. Happy Talk was number two. Best Radio DJ.
82.
David Kid Jensen.
Steve Wright.
Mike Reed.
Who fucking voted? Jesus.
And the best TV show?
I
reckon Top of the Pops.
Yeah.
Top of the Pops. Of course it's Top of the Pops.
How obtuse of me.
On the cover of The Enemy this week, Paul Weller in a nice John Steed outfit with the hook of an umbrella around his neck. On the cover of Smash Hits, Tears for Fears. The number one LP at the moment is the John Lennon collection. The singles, The First 10 Years by ABBA, is number two. Dig the New Breed, the live compilation by The Jam, is at number three. And the highest placed proper LP is Rio by Duran Duran at number four. Over in America, the number one single at the moment is Man Eater by Hall & Oates. And the number one LP in America is Business As Usual by Men at Work for its sixth week. It would spend 15 weeks at number one in America, that album.
Fucking why?
Hell. So, me dear boys, what were we doing in December of 1982?
Oh, well, I would have been about 10. So, really, my memories, of course, of this time, December, are very, very Christmas related and to do with the presents that I wanted. And the presents I was hoping to get. I remember that December being quite a snowy one.
Yes.
Although it was, wasn't it? I'm not just imagining that. I remember it being a really snowy one. And I seem to recall it being the year of just yearning for an Astro Wars. Mm. It was the year that came out and I so wanted it for Christmas. And the happy ending to this story, I did get it. It was the following year.
With the power pack this time.
With the power pack. Yes. It was the following year. I was getting confused with the ZX Spectrum because I think I got that the following year.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it was all about the Astro Wars that year. It was a year in which I think I was already, in a sense, I mean, I was being tutored in music by my sister, as usual. She was a big Duran fan. Mm. And I wasn't that into Duran, so I started exploring the older music that she was bringing out. It was very much an era pre-me playing an instrument, of me having a tennis racket and pretending to play guitar, and having that pop fantasy of being in all of these bands. So in my head, I ran a kind of reel where in the 60s I was in the Rolling Stones, and in the 70s I was Mick Rock, you know, this strange kind of idea that I could be in all these bands. That was then only followed, of course, by the white... There's no more incandescent fury than when you realise that when you've been dancing around with a tennis racket playing, you know, playing a guitar, that your mum has been watching you for five minutes, grinning. I think it's the start of that thing that, you know... Being 10 is a great age, actually, because you're not a kid no more, really. And you're not a moody teenager yet, but I do recall a lot of door slamming and kind of, you know, sticking the visa at the door after it slams, you know what I mean? So, it was a blissful time, actually, 1982 in a sense. I've just moved to the very house that I'm sitting in now. And just settling in. It was nice. It was quiet. Nice snowy winter. I've got really good memories of 82.
I never used a tennis racket. when I was playing guitar because I didn't have one.
Mm.
Did I have a cricket bat? I think I had a cricket bat. So cricket bat, yeah. But what I had was my dad, who was working as a removal man, so he'd bring any crap that was being chucked out. My mum vetted it to decide whether it was good for the house or not. We had those old school warming pans.
Oh, right, yeah. The ones that warm up your bed.
I saw it more as a bass than a guitar.
Yeah.
And my mate once came calling for me in around about 1980 and caught me directly in front of the mirror, giving it proper musician cum face to the bass line of Fashion by David Bowie.
Yeah.
And so for the next 4 years until we left school, every now and again, if he wanted to wind me up, he'd just look at me and just go, beep, beep, and piss himself laughing and see my face go red. And it was just a thing between me and him. It was never revealed why that would set me off. He never said anything, and I certainly never said anything. So there you go. Yeah, if you are using a warming pan as a base, Pop Crazy Youngsters, make sure all the curtains are drawn. What about you, David?
Well, I was going to say,
I bet you used the edge of your bed as a keyboard, didn't you, when you were listening to Faust and all that?
I was going to say, I would never have used anything, a bedpan or a tennis, as a guitar, because guitars were raucous, they were phallic, and if you're going to listen to guitar or pretend to play guitar, you might as well have been voting conservative, as far as I'm concerned. None of that for me, no. I was a bit of a soul boy at this point, but also into all kind of weird avant-garde stuff. Avid reader of Enemy, the sort of avant-garde ending, Morley's, Penmans, and, you know, and forming it. And also into that kind of new pop thing, ABC, Scritti, and stuff like that. And it genuinely was a golden time. Mm. I mean, obviously it helps that one is at a certain age, you know.
Yes.
One thing at that point is I would have worn a shirt and tie every single day.
Wow.
At that point, everything. I've never done it. Really done it since. Now I try and dress like some sort of like Sports Direct kid, you know. Some people might think I'm 38 as opposed to 58. You know, pathetic, really. But then it was a matter of pride. Mm. I remember going to a Fall gig in '82 around that time, dressed like that, tie, very very neat and fitted. Marky Smith, I can't remember what the song is or what the lyric was, but it's very sardonic of some sort of like type, you know, that he despises, that's sort of festering and like, you know, marinating one of his lyrics. And he said, and then he sort of looks directly at me in the audience and said, "He's here tonight." He's going to wear a tie, you know.
That's brilliant.
I reminded him that because I interviewed him a few times and he didn't remember, but the strange thing was that I probably felt, you know, highly attuned to the world because it was at the kind of, you know, felt at the avant-garde end of things. But I was probably, I think that you and the age that you guys were probably much more connected with stuff as it actually was. Because, for instance, I didn't watch television at all at that point, or barely watched television. You know, I didn't know what were like kids' shows and stuff like that. There's all kinds of signifiers and things from the early 80s that I just don't get because I was in this slightly kind of rarefied atmosphere. So that was me in 82. And I did have a good time, I have to say.
December 1982 is my period of mourning over the Jam.
Damn, mate.
Who have just played their final gig. So I'm sitting at home in my bedroom rinsing Dig the New Breed, the posthumous live LP, which was only the second Jam LP that I could, you know, actually buy and consume at the same time as everybody else.
Mm.
Just lying on my bed listening to it, thinking I'll never see them ever.
Oh, mate.
I know. I'm halfway through the third year at comprehensive school, and on the last day of term a week before, I got done.
Yeah.
This was the time of the milk advert, yeah, lot of bottle. And I started singing, "Sir has worked in a lot of brothels." Just dragged off to the staff room and made to sit outside, and he said, "I'll come and talk to you later." And I'm sitting there outside the staff room just wondering what's going to happen to me. All the teachers are filing in, laughing and pointing at me and going, "Oh, you're here again, are you? Merry Christmas," and all this. And every time the door opens, I notice that the tables that they've set up are being absolutely weighed down with beer and wine because they're having their end of term piss up. And every time the door swings open, there's more and more booze, and the pall of fag smoke gets bigger and bigger. And I end up sitting there for 2 hours. I'd just been forgotten about. And then all of a sudden, the teacher that done there, he comes out absolutely pissed out of his face to get in his car and go home. And he just turns around, he stares at me, and then he says, "Merry Christmas, now piss off." that was it. That was the first time it actually occurred to me that teachers didn't really give a toss about you. Mm. I always used to think that my teachers would be lying in bed thinking, oh, I'll need him. Oh, he infuriates me so. Oh, why doesn't he knuckle down and get a better grade and all this kind of stuff? Because you just think that your teachers do nothing but think about you and get angry about you and think of ways of fucking your life up. No, they don't give a shit, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
Just want to get pissed up and cop off with each other and smoke loads of fags.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I used to have this apprehension that, you know, for quite a long time, I was probably about 15 or 16 before I was disabused of it, that teachers hated holidays because teaching was essentially their life. And, like, you know, when they weren't teaching, they were just like, might as well be hanging in a cupboard or something like that. Yeah. And, that, you know, and I always felt slightly, like, my joy at the holidays is always tempered by the fact that I thought, well, this is going to be rubbish for you teachers, isn't it? You know, you're not doing the thing that you're... function to do. But I think Neil will possibly spare me out that that's perhaps not the case.
Well, absolutely not the case. But I mean, it's so changed. I mean, you know, the staff room, when I was a kid at my school, the staff room, I'm not saying it's some sacred place, but we didn't exactly get to see it. Do you know what I mean? It was a place that you sat outside waiting to get bollocked. And it was down a corridor. You didn't really know what went on in that room. Whereas now, you know, if I need a chat with a student, I do have to take them to the frickin' staff room. No privacy no more.
God, no, no.
I used to think that the school staff room would be, like, full of globes and scrolls and dictionaries and stuff like that. You know, be an extra place of learning and contemplation. No, it was just full of fucking cans of Long Life and wine boxes and ashtrays, endless amounts of ashtrays.
The ability to smoke inside an educational institution, I only tasted that for 2 years when I started teaching in 2005. Mate. But so much shit gets sorted in the smoking room, always does. But that hallowed ground of the staff room, that slight sense of mystery with teachers, we're not allowed to have it in a sense. We've got a glad hand, you know. We can't rise above. We have to kind of be friendly. It's part of the movement towards customer service notions of education, I think.
Yes.
But it's, I remember the staff room just being this hallowed, slightly scary place that you certainly didn't want to go into or look into.
No,
but was intriguingly mysterious, yeah.
I mean, there were some pretty fearless types at my school, like this kid called Kevin Burke. You know, we had a French teacher who's quite tall, a big bill, and like he's at the height of, like, the, you know, it's 1977. And remember, he put a safety pin right through his nose, and it was all kind of scratching and bleeding. And he came out of the staff room and he shouted at Big Bill, "Punk rock!" You know, and we thought, God, you know, and that's how. But he would never have thought or even dared actually to have, like, gone into that staff room and, like, you know, You know, even then, I mean, even someone like Kevin Burke knew that the staff room was absolutely sacred and out of bounds, you know, that, you know, you'd probably get flogged or something like that. They'd probably sort of wheel out some sort of, like, you know, sort of punishment equipment from the Billy Bunter's era or something like that, if you were to dare, you know, unprecedented.
Currently, when you're sat in a staff room and the door knocks, you have to answer it, and it's usually a student, and they can see you through the glass of the door, so much so that I actually blocked it up with the newspaper. Just so I could retain some sense of privacy.
That's like going to a restaurant and thinking you can just walk into the fucking kitchen.
Well, the reason being, I didn't want them seeing what was on the whiteboard, which was just a list of students that we all fucking hated. We can retain a bit of it, but increasingly now we're kind of out and visible. I think teachers benefit from that special place where they can just talk honestly, have a fag as well. That used to make a big, big difference.
Passing round the ready rum.
This is it, this is it. But no, that's all gone now.
But after, if you watch any of those educating series, you know, Essex, Yorkshire, man, I'm just absolutely astonished by them. I think, Christ alive, things have really, really moved on over the last 3 or 4 decades.
Oh, yeah. And when I think about really what went on in my school in particular in the 70s, all of my moaning about Ofsted that invariably as a teacher I always do, thank fuck for Ofsted. Because when schools weren't inspected and they were just allowed to fucking get on with it, it covered up a lot of horrible shit. So it's probably a good thing about the more openness. But I think the staff room should still be, a place where when you open the door, all that comes out is the smell of sour defeat, rage, bitterness, and fag smoke, basically.
Incidentally, Al, just a little side, you mentioned getting done got done. And we got done in Leeds in the 70s. I just wonder if it's something that's spread down to Coventry. Did you used to get done?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. Got done. No, absolutely.
Yeah.
Just usually I got done, you know, full stop. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, truth be told, I stand outside my daughter's school every day and listen to all these year sevens coming out in year eights, and don't ask what that means, but basically little kids and big kids. But basically, you'd be glad to know the kids are still swearing.
Yes.
Kids are still being horrible to each other. Kids are still hitting each other. Same old shit's still happening. Don't think that kids are coming out joyfully talking about education. They're coming out calling each other cunts and whores and bastards and shits and all of that. It's all the same stuff. Yeah.
Do they still stand around in circles spitting into a kind of communal pool of phlegm?
Yeah. Yes. Oh, yeah, boys still gather in circles. Yeah. Absolutely, yeah, that still happens.
Cool. Yeah.
The other big event of this month, of course, is that I'd gone the week before to see E.T. with my mates.
Did you cry?
Because it finally came out in the UK. American pop craze youngsters, they won't get this at all. But, you know, back then, the release dates in Britain and America were just fucking months and months and months apart. Because E.T.'s a summer film in America.
Yeah.
And to us, it's a Christmas one. More of a Halloween one, actually. You know, because as we've pointed out in a previous episode, E.T. ruined Halloween.
Yeah, yeah. It's where Halloween is birthed in this country.
E.T. ruined Bonfire Night for everyone.
Yeah, totally, yeah. Yeah.
Actually, I say we went to see E.T. We actually went to the ABC to point and laugh at people who were crying at E.T.
You bastard.
I don't remember much of the film, but I do remember my mates pointing and doing that snappy finger thing whenever we saw someone roaring and going, "Ah, shame!" and people telling us to fuck off. Shame was the Nottingham version of Bad Skit.
Oh, my God.
I mean, even I didn't see many films at that point, but I did see E.T., yeah, yeah. With a girl who cried. You'd have probably been very cruel to her, Al.
Shame, guy.
I'd have had to sort of say something as well. I'd have to stand up to you.
It's always funny that when aliens come down to Earth, they always end up in America.
Yeah.
It's never Bangladesh or...
Or Basingstoke.
Or Hungary or anywhere like that, is it? Or here, or Britain.
Yeah, no. No, of course not, no.
Because if you're an alien, you're obviously an intelligent being. You just go, I'm not going near America. They've all got fucking guns. Let's go to Britain. We'll batter them cunts. Mm. What they got? Death Stars.
The best thing I got out of E.T., and this is a genuinely sublime artifact, is an electro-funk classic by the Extra Tees called E.T. Boogie.
Yes.
Mm.
Great stuff, if you know that, yeah.
Yeah, well, that reminds me, because around about this time I was going to Rock City on a Saturday afternoon because they had a kids' disco, sometimes hosted by Dale Winton.
Wow.
And I remember him playing that song and saying, "Have you seen the film yet?" And me sort of half putting my hand up because I hadn't really. I'd seen people crying at it. The other thing I really hate about E.T. is it's his fault for fucking M&M's being so popular in this country. And they're shit. Give him some Revels. You know, because sometimes you get an orange one and they're nice. And sometimes you get a coffee one and they're not so nice. And that would have taught E.T. more about humanity, I think.
Having a daughter, I've had to go to M&M World in Leicester Square.
Why?
Oh, God, I don't, you know, I mean, it's a shame. We never had Revels World, did we, in the 70s?
No, we didn't, no.
Yeah. But to M&M, oh, God, it's just...
Well, yeah, I mean, normal M&M's, not as nice as Smarties. And peanut M&M's, not as nice as Treats.
No, exactly.
Treats were fucking gorgeous. I loved them.
Yeah.
And they were three times the size as well.
Quite yes. Right. God, we're a bunch of old bastards, aren't we?
Yes, we are. But we're right.
Revels World. I would have gone there, I must admit.
Yeah, different zones, an orange zone, a coffee zone, yeah.
Revels World would be, you go there and it changes every day, so you don't know what you're going to get.
Yeah, you might get that really weird minstrel without the candy shell that always used to pop up in a revel as well, yeah.
All right, M-Pulp Craze youngsters, you know how we go about at this point of the proceedings. We're going to rummage through a box or two and pull out an issue of the music press from this very week. And this week, I have gone for Melody Maker of December the 18th, 1982. Boys, shall we leaf through it?
Oh, yes.
On the cover, Shalimar. with Jeffrey Daniel in full kilted regalia, underneath some painted-on balloons because it's the Christmas edition, plus a cover-mounted flexi-disc of The Jam playing Move On Up live in Japan. Oh, yes, I bought this. At the beginning of this, some English voice going, Yuko Say Say Issue Bin Otty Totty The Jam! It's the only Japanese I know.
That cover is pretty damn garish. Melody Maker went through a strange phase at this stage. Just about a couple of years earlier, it had people like John Savage and Chris Bunn writing for it, and it had that kind of sort of gravitas and big page features about this heat and Cabaret Voltaire and all that kind of stuff. And then I think a conscious decision was made to steer it in the direction of being an inky smash hits.
Right.
Which, as we saw in its very last incarnation, Moneymaker is not something anybody in the world really wants. And I think sales may have started to tumble at this point. And it's definitely a world away. I'd definitely abandon Melody Maker at this point. The Enemy, there was a world between them at this point.
Was that change signified by the change in the masthead? Was that because that MM masthead that I'm
seeing always
there,
been a problem, right? MM. Now, the trouble is, and I think this is always, it's hugely fateful, actually, in terms of the acronym. NME comes out really nicely as an acronym. NME. And so they're able to ditch this whole ridiculous stage, New Musical Express, you know, that 6-5 special type connotation. MM, it just doesn't slip out in the same way. And so it tends to get saddled with Melody Maker, you know, and all the connotations of 1926 and Edgar Jackson and all that kind of stuff. You know.
In the news, the rainbow in Finsbury Park has been taken over by squatters. It's Crass and some of their mates who are planning to stay there for a bit as a protest against their latest tour being cancelled over the release of How Does It Feel to Be the Mother of 1,000 Dead. There were 30 of us. We went in through the emergency exit. We did no criminal damage and we can't be evicted because the courts have closed for Christmas, says band guitarist Andy Palmer. Anyone who hasn't got anywhere to stay can stay with us. There's plenty of room, the heating, electric and hot water are all on, and we're quite comfortable. They plan to play a free gig at some point, but after being forcibly evicted after Melody Maker has gone to press, they end up squatting in the abandoned Zigzag Club in Westbourne Park and have a lovely time. Good old Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. There's just a couple of little things leap out from me at that. There's almost like something quaint, for instance, about how does it feel to be the mother of 1,000 dead. It's a bit like that moment in the Austin Powers film where Dr. Evil is being, you know, defrozen. He says, and I will blow up the world unless I receive $1 million. You know, 1,000 dead. It's just like, come on, man, that's not very much. You know, these days, you know, war crimes, you're talking, it'll be 100,000 dead. You know, it's almost like simpler, quainter, smaller scale times, I guess. You know, and the squatting and all that is really cool. I mean, you know, it was such a moral panic about squatting, I suppose. Well, especially in the 70s. Remember that there was an episode of Bless This House where Sid leaves out for a while and then somebody just strolls in because he's left the door open and, you know, squatters' rights, you know. I mean, that's what we went through in the 70s. It was that was the reality of like suburban life, you know.
Heavy Metal Records announced that they have no plans to withdraw the LP cover and accompanying advertising for their latest release, Death Penalty, by Stalbridge band Witchfinder General. The LP, which features Page Three lovely Joanne Latham sat on a grave with her jubblies out, surrounded by the band in Civil War costumes on the front, and Joanne all stabbed up and dead on the back, caused a string of complaints to the Advertising Standards Authority after it featured in a free magazine given away by HMV. The label say that the cover is, quote, merely a reenactment of a factual event which took place during the 18th century when the Witchfinder General Matthew Hopkins led a reign of terror against women of the day and is in the best possible taste. Unbelievable.
I'll tell you what, Neil, Carol Clark would have been working on the news desk at this point, assistant news editor. I can just imagine her sort of raucously chuckling away at this story. It's got all kind of fingerprints all over it, the whole thing.
Definitely. But I mean, it's a time, I think, that, you know, the early 80s in particular, where metal is on a mission to outrage people. Because I think Venom have basically upped the stakes here. Because Venom are coming out with songs called, like, Fuck Off and Die and things like that. So it was definitely becoming that music that was unsafe. At this period. By the way, Death Penalty by Witchfinder General is a fucking terrible album. But
is it?
Well, they're from Stourbridge, for fuck's sake. You know, I mean, enough said. But, I mean, you know, it's a pretty awful record. But metal, I was picking up a few metal mates by now. Even though I was only 10, of course, for a 10-year-old, all of this stuff is just delightful and stuff that you want to you're interested in, but it's also slightly forbidden. It's kind of percolated down from elder brothers who were into this shit. But yeah, that's definitely happened in this period, and it's a period of maximum outrage, especially for British provincial metal bands like Witchfinder General and Venom. They're at peak ridiculousness at this era.
Yeah, it's a bit smell the glove, isn't it? So what you're saying is that if you're going to own 6 Witchfinder General albums, this wouldn't be one of them.
No, bypass this one.
5 bouncers at Elton's Disco in Tottenham are in court accused of attacking members of Modern Romance. According to the prosecution, the group, who were there to celebrate lead singer David James's birthday, were told to stop singing along to the songs being played at the disco. And after former frontman Jeff Dean was escorted from the premises, an argument ensued, and one of the defendants is alleged to have said, "Get the tools." Quote, total mayhem ensued. Former drummer Kevin Steptoe was struck in the face with an ashtray, James was biffed, and Dean was told, "Shut up or I'll cut you," by the helpful staff. The trial concludes in the new year.
Fuck me.
God, man, who'd want to beat up Modern Romance?
Yeah, but this is the weird thing, though. I mean, probably they were probably a fairly sort of predictably soft target, but you didn't necessarily mess with the young New Romantics. You know, people like Chris Sullivan out of Blue Rondo of the Tour, you know, he's quite a hard case. Boy George came from a boxing family. And I tell you, used to, like, 1982, I would have gone to, like, the Warehouse in Leeds, and there were everyone's, like, in top hat and tails. They're all fucking hard northern bastards, you know, sort of, you know, steal my pint types. Yeah, so... yeah, could have all worked out differently, this one.
That store is just a great advert, isn't it, for Elton's Disco in Tottenham?
Yes.
Must go there. But, I mean, of course, this is the day, these are the days when ashtrays could do some proper damage. Big weighty glass things,
I like the idea of like drummer Kevin Steptoe being the kind of Steptoe grandson, you know, and a whole sort of
Oh, it could have carried on, couldn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Meanwhile, at Snaresbrook Crown Court, a judge dismisses a case of handling stolen goods brought by CBS, EMI, and Polygram against Cheapo Records in Soho and the Woodford Green Vinyl Scrapyard. The labels are claiming that the free records given away by them to disc jockeys and music journos still belong to them and could not be sold on, but the judge ruled that they were talking bollocks. Polygram have responded by saying they'll be reviewing their system of sending out promo copies in the new year. Ugh. That would have affected your lot big star, wouldn't it?
Going to say, this is a landmark ruling for people in my world. People would literally have died if it hadn't been, you know.
Yeah.
How much extra money on the side were you making a week from your review copies?
I think it depended on your scruples, basically. I mean, some people made an awful lot. I probably might have made about 150 extra months, which is pretty modest. There are a lot of people who are doing a lot better. And I think in the 90s, I think there were certain people who just did the rounds of, you know, all these old companies like Phonogram, EMI and Warners, and just came away with, like, loads and loads of promo stuff. And they went directly around to, you know, just to flog it in
Berwick Street. Record and tape exchange.
Yeah.
Tape exchange, yeah. Or whoever's doing the best rates, yeah. I mean, some people were very, very unscrupulous about it. I was moderately unscrupulous, but people would have died if it went for this reason.
Yeah.
Definitely. Starved to death.
God bless the QC in this case, because, I mean, you know, that stuff, it kept my lights on several occasions, you know, in the 90s. Yeah. It kept my kids fed. No, genuinely, I mean, I wasn't one that sort of used to deliberately ask for promos just for this purpose. But I kind of build up a backlog, you know, like about 3-4 months worth, and then I'd get rid. And it will always be at that moment that invariably happens with any freelancer's career, when, you know, you've got, what, 2 weeks to go until you might get paid. And you're completely brassically skint. It was a godsend. For me, it was a place called Entertainment Exchange in Nuneaton. It did necessitate going to Nuneaton, but I was in out quick before I caught nits. But it was, you know, without that, my God, without that judgment, in fact. Yeah, I mean, I would have really struggled a lot, I think, throughout the 90s.
What's the naughtiest thing you've done then with promo records?
What do you mean? What do you mean naughty? What do you mean?
Well, in the sense that, you know, you sold something on before it actually officially came out.
Ooh. That could have happened, yeah.
I've sold a few things. When the industry got wise to all this, that things were getting flogged on, especially in the late nights, I noticed a lot of CDs turning up and tapes turning up that were watermarked. And what I mean by that is, some of them actually had like the insertion of kind of messages. This is a promo copy from, you know, and all of that.
Pentas used to get loads of tapes sent, but I think Pentas was pretty low on the record company's list. So we just got tapes with just white noise every 30 seconds. Because honestly, they go, well, it's a wank mag, isn't it? They're not going to fucking, who cares? Who cares what they think?
But in terms of the actual bootlegging, I mean, it was never journalists. Journalists would have known how to sort of, like, you know, do all that kind of stuff. It was, I mean, I remember one time, I got a weird one like that. It was a Tori Amos album, and they sent it over. It was just welded into a Discman type thing. Mm. You couldn't get it out of there, you know. So they basically sacrificed a Discman, you know, just for the sake of a promo copy. It was extraordinary.
Fuck.
That's crazy.
Mm. Imagine being on a desert island and that washes up. Fuck.
They did try everything, because I remember interviewing bands, and towards the late 90s, a thing started happening, especially with big major labels. They'd invite you to interview a band and they wouldn't send you a promo. What they'd do is they'd put you in a room beforehand with something on a mini disc or something like that, and that was your sole access to it. And you had like an hour to listen to it and write down the questions, and that was it. Mm. They tried everything. I mean, for me, the golden age of getting this shit was not actually CDs. It was that beautiful little window, in a sense, for me. It's very evocative. Sort of early 90s to mid 90s. Of course, that's resonant for me, but it was those tapes, those black tapes that you only got from record companies. It's tape promos that I really miss in this era of download codes and streaming and all of that. I really miss those tapes. It was thrilling getting those, and brilliant for having a Walkman and stuff like that.
Yeah, because, I mean, in the early 90s, I worked at the Record and Tape Exchange for a while, like half of London did. And I became on nod in terms of one or two music journalists who were just bringing in armfuls of this shit. Mm-hmm. And the minute they came in, the staff would descend upon them because they were, you know, to them, they were minor celebrities. Mm. But also, more importantly, they had good shit that you actually wanted.
Mm. I didn't get descended on by anybody in the Record and Tape Exchange. £15 is generally what I got offered for my box full of things.
What was the most you ever got then for one item?
Ooh. God, I used to send them off as a job lot. I did actually once get, I did get a promo cassette of What's the Story, Morning Glory, which had the track that they had to take off because it was so obviously a rip off of Stevie Wonder's Uptight as it kind of stepped.
Right. Yeah,
and I think I managed to sort of get about £25 for that at some point, but that's you know, pretty pitiful, really.
Yeah, it was a job lot. It was always for me. It was kind of like, here's a box, you deal with it. I'll come back in half an hour and tell me how much, you know, you're offering. And then a bit of barring. But I wasn't in a position to, you know, argue the toss in a sense. I needed to get my electricity back in my house. Do you know what I mean? It was always that kind of thing, or feed my children.
Also, in the mid-90s, drug habits serviced as well. Yeah, I mean, there were some, you know, mentioning no names, but there were some pretty desperate.
Yes. Absolutely. It's instant, it's an instant little baggy. If you can take 200 promos down there, Record and Tape Exchange, you're sorted for kind of a couple of days, I guess.
And the British invasion of 1982 culminates with the Weekly World News reporting on Boy George, who they call a slinky songbird who drives British teen boys wild. Is it a her, a him, or is it neither? Reports the supermarket tabloid. This kind of sexual mix-up could create an entire generation of homosexuals, said a concerned parent that they made up in the office on Deadline.
Laughing in the box office, they did so, no doubt.
In the interview section, well, two pages are given over to photos of the last ever jam gig at the Brighton Centre, which mainly consist of the band members sitting on their own smoking fags and an untouched cake. Paolo Hewitt reports that it wasn't the show many expected or wanted. the band played up too much to the audience, and ultimately it was the audience who let them down by throwing bottles and rubbish, prompting an angry Bruce Foxton to shout, "I want to remember this last gig for the good moments, not the bottles."
Aww.
Yeah.
That's as heart-rending a live moment as Robert Plant's "Does Anyone Remember Laughter?" That's really poignant.
Oh. Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five are in town to play some gigs at the venue, and Ian Pye gets to knock about with them. They get massively confused by the bidets in their hotel bathrooms, assuming they're for washing babies in, but are dead impressed at the changing of the guard. They tell him that it makes a nice change to play in countries that have gun laws, because in New York, if an ashtray drops on the floor, everyone thinks it's a gunshot, and they all leg it out the building.
Yeah, I would have seen them play on this tour.
Wow.
Actually, Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five. I remember, like, they did they do a kind of sort of mock stage fight at one point with baseball bats, and it was actually pretty scary. And I was actually for about a good minute or so convinced this, there was genuinely kicking off on stage. So.
That record, though, the Grandmaster Flash that year, the message. That, I mean, I often trace back my love of hip hop to that moment when I'm in a back of a Hillman Inn. On an upward slope in the snowy December of 1982, and the message comes on. And I'm not going to say my whole life started there, but in a way it did. You know, in a sense, that was my first signifier that rap music was not just going to be this fad of pop, but was just going to be this thing that was amazing by itself. Yeah, I'll never forget that moment.
Steve Sutherland draws the short straw and ends up in a hotel bar with Bow Wow Wow, who have just finished an acrimonious divorce with Malcolm McLaren and have got a cob on with the music press. "What you saw," air quotes, "pop stars," asks Sutherland. "Well, they provide you with a living for a start, hippie," snaps Matthew Ashman, and the conversation goes downhill from there. Annabella Lewin asks which paper this interview is for. "Hippie Weekly," says Ashman.
Witty stuff.
The male members of the band take turns to call Malcolm McLaren a cunt, brag on about how many women they've nobbed in 1982, and say that Annabella is as dumb as she looks, which causes her to storm out in tears. Ashman goes after her, then comes back, claiming he's just shagged her in the toilets and locked her in, as Sutherland sees her putting her coat on and storming out onto the street.
God, it's in between us stuff, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's fucking horrible, isn't it, that?
That is, that's really, yeah, it's really horrible. It's funny, the only remotely thing, it's strange, I mean, Steve Sutherland, calling Steve Sutherland a hippie, I mean, in terms of, like, look and demeanour, no one was less hippie than Steve Sutherland on this planet. And yet, at the same time, he was a huge deadhead. So
yeah, it's odd. Steve always looked like he should have had, like, 72-hole docks on.
You ever had a chippy interview like that where someone just wants to have a go at the music press?
Yeah. I mean, nothing so bad as this, to be honest, actually. I don't know, I seem to have a very disarming interview style, and I don't seem to sort of wind people up somehow, you know.
I did a little bit with the bloke out of Gay Dad.
Right.
But that interview was a disaster.
Who was a music journalist.
Yeah, this is it. But he took that kind of confrontational. I mean, some bands do make that decision, but what they normally can't cope with is when you just answer back. You know, and you tell them to fuck off, etc. Call them a cunt. They can't deal with that, really. So that normally gets you out of that situation.
Yeah. I think one of the most disillusioning things for me when I first went into music journalism, I thought that you could have really good sort of spirited, you know, not necessarily sort of nasty confrontation, but spirited arguments, debates with bands, you know, really get them to define their terms, put them on the spot, whatever, give as good as you got, you know, etc., etc. Right? But you just realise that the bands generally just weren't up to it. And in the end, you just end up sort of, you know, these sort of limp wretches, you know, helping them kind of like limp through the whole process. And sometimes, actually, if they couldn't come up with anything better than yeah or no, you'd actually say something, you know, quite detailed that they might want to say about themselves that's kind of quite eloquent and descriptive of them. You'd put that in it. And if at the end of it, they went, then you'd actually sort of resort to pretending that they actually said it.
Yeah.
You know, and there's all this stuff about, you know, they took us out of context. And, you know, we took you out of context and made you look intelligent is what we did 95% of the time.
Yeah, no, absolutely. The only complaints I've had post-interviews from bands when they've seen this stuff in print is when I've made them sound good, you know, because they were so fucking boring. Whereas if you interview, I don't know. Usually it's the ones who fancy themselves as articulate, actually, who often aren't. And it's your Sean Ryders who gives you just gold. You know, just naturally.
And the heavy metal people, always.
Oh, yeah, always a hoot.
Paolo Hewitt stays in Brighton to greet the breakout band of 1982, Shalimar. Jeffrey Daniel tells him about how his look has been influenced by British bands like Hazy Fantasia, Culture Club and Fashion, and he's only nicking back the black hairstyles that they originally copped off the Americans. He also expresses bemusement about how British bands love slagging each other off, while American groups like them are all nice religious boys and girls. 7 months later, Daniel will break the news that Shalimar had split up in his next Melody Maker interview. Oh, Shalimar. Here too briefly.
I know. I did spend many months of 1982 failing to moonwalk, I have to say.
David Frick examines the cultural phenomenon of the year in music, the British invasion. He deduces that while punk kicked over the apple cart over here, causing labels to sign up anyone and anything in fear of missing out, it did next to fuck all in America, a country still in its 70s hangover, and only the black radio stations are picking up on British electropop. He concludes with the prediction that the taste for British bands will either die on its arse in America very soon, or those bands will be forced to compromise and become the new dinosaurs.
I think what's interesting for me, actually, is that he's kind of right in the sense that punk wasn't this kind of seismic BC AD event it was in the UK for various kind of cultural reasons. I always think that, like, you know, retrospectively, I think, you know, the Pistols were respected, but possibly, you know, like for Steve Jones's guitar, they were almost like this kind of hard rock continuum, you know, that kind of was Led Zeppelin, the Sex Pistols, Nirvana, as if it was all part of the kind of same thing. You know, the idea that it represented this kind of cultural sort of rupture doesn't seem to have quite occurred.
But he's right, isn't he, in predicting that they've become the new dinosaurs? Because, and it's America, in a sense, that does that to some of those bands. You know, you go from, I don't know, say Depeche Mode 81, 82, on Top of the Pops, and then you see them, what, 3-4 years later, in those documentaries, you know, counting out the thousands of dollars backstage that they're making at these huge, huge stadium shows that they were playing in Britain before. So he's spot on there. He's spot on,
especially with Depeche Mode, who it's astonishing. I've never been able to kind of quite figure out how that happened to them, you know, and what the kind of little shifts and things were that they made, you know, from the very earliest sort of incarnation and then to become that. It's, you know, much as I've read about it and looked at it, it continues to mystify me, actually. You know, I'm not anti-Depeche Mode, I'm not a huge fan, but it's extraordinary.
Talking of which, Paul Simper meets a flock of seagulls at a pizza land in Liverpool who are back in town for Christmas, and he sits back as they give it the large one at the local bands who used to look down their noses at them and make cawing seagull noises at them in the street. When asked about their ridiculous amount of success in America, frontman Mike Score puts it down to the fact that, unlike other bands, they've put the graft in over there, they're not arty, and they actually love gigging and being in America. When asked about his ambitions for 1983, Score says, a new hairdo.
Yeah.
Colin Irwin wins the raffle and bags a trip to Barbados to meet its newest and most famous resident, Eddie Grant. He spends his first day looking on in terror as fellow Junket member Mike of Roots magazine batters the locals at pool, keeps his distance from Mike Malloy of the Daily Mirror, who has put a dog lead on a massive turtle and fails to get locals to pretend that they're taking it out for a walk for a photo, and then watches him get pissed up in a nearby hotel, bum-rushing a local covers band and forcing them to do Proud Mary while he whirls the mic around like Roger Daltrey. In the actual interview, Grant tells him that he thought Two Tone was musical masturbation, believes that while the Clash and Rockers' Revenge have covered his songs with respect, other bands have given his songs the musical equivalent of herpes, coats down Bob Marley for allowing himself to be publicised as a spliffhead, and calls the rock and roll ethos a pile of crap.
Wow. I'll tell you what, there was no bloody raffle. Every few years, the Eddie Grant trip, you know, to Barbados was something that senior editors availed of in terms of, you know, for senior privilege. A few years later, it was Alan Jones, you know, suddenly declaring a love for mainstream reggae that had never been particularly conspicuous in his writings, you know, and skanking around, you know, the office. Yeah, I think I'll have this one. Yeah. Absolutely shocking stuff.
I'm surprised by Grant saying that. I mean, if Two Tone is musical masturbation, that's not a wank I want to have. That's not a leisurely wank, is it? That's
no, it's frantic.
It's frantic, and yeah, you end up shooting your bolt into a pork pie hat. No, thank you. I don't get that at all.
Singles reviews. Well, there aren't any this week, but the Melody Maker single of the year is The Message by Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five, and the LP of the year is Sulk by The Associates.
Excellent choices, both.
Yeah. That's again, you know, yeah, impressed again. Yeah. I was so snobbish, though, at this point, that The Message was almost becoming a cliche, you know, because it has been so sort of revered, you know, and and I also had that thing about fascist groove thing, the Mussolini records like that, you know, and I had to be kind of a sort of vine to be more obscure than now, you know. You went the DAF, I went the 23 Skidoo, you know. If I went with The Message by Grandmaster Flash, you know, I went with How Are We Going to Make the Black Nation Rise and all that kind of stuff. Painful boy. But no, excellent suggestions.
In the LP review section, well, as you'd expect, there's not much out this week. So the main review is given over to Carol Clark raving about Pissed and Proud, the debut live LP by, quote, the thick-skinned, cider-soaked Walt Disney's of punk, Peter and the Test Tube Babies. The Babies are brash and blatant and barbaric, larger than life in a curiously down-to-earth manner. They are, in my humble opinion, one of the most entertaining punk bands in the country, and this album merely confirms it.
I've spoken before about what a hero Carol Clark was to me, but I just want to say, it was the anniversary of her passing recently, and I had never, ever read the initial piece that got her in at MM. That, you know, the diary of a Northern Irish music fan,
right?
That she wrote, and it's a wonderful piece. I could, you know, I read it the other day, and I can just really see why she got hired. I think she was great.
I think it was quite early, though, wasn't it? Something like 1972. She was only a teenager.
It was very early, yeah. I mean, and she just sent it in on, you know, she just sent it in almost like a letter, and it's just a brilliant, vivid piece, a wonderful piece, yeah.
Paul Simper takes one look at the tracklist of the new Al Green LP, Precious Lord, and is horrified to discover that it's tainted with the musk of Stars on Sunday. But once he tucks in, he's delighted to find, quote, a lovely collection of songs which will undoubtedly move some people while simply being enjoyed by others.
Wonderful turn of phrase.
Yes. However, it's a coat down for Main Attraction, the eighth album by Susie Quattro. According to Brian Harrigan, she was never convincing as a rock and roller in her heyday, and now that her tough lady in a tough world approach has been completely superseded by the likes of Girl School, who really know how to rock hard, this LP doesn't help matters. The songs are, without exception, weak and badly pieced together, pallid pop masquerading as something more muscular. Harrigan suggests that her and Len Tuckey should check out the new Sounds of Metal to put some fire back in their veins. She should do a cover with a bloke on a grave with his knob out and her hammering stakes into his chest. And Brian Case froths at the mouth with glee at Live at the Albany Empire by the Flying Pickets. There isn't a dud here or any number that isn't performed without wit and great musical skill. Buy this album to help you through Christmas and make it a New Year's resolution to see them as soon as possible. The best around. Brian Case, they're predicting next year's Christmas number one.
Yeah, not bad. It's funny with Brian Case, because he was a staff writer at Melody Maker, but he'd really been sort of hired in its jazz era, you know, when it was still covering a lot of jazz, which it still was in the sort of late 70s. And I think by 1982, really, he was pretty peripheral, really, but he was still sitting on this staff job. And he was still there in 1987.
Like you in the 90s, then?
Yeah, I was just going to, yeah, exactly, yeah, pretty much, yeah. I'm a bed blocker, yeah. But I eventually got his job, yeah. He went over to Time Out in 1987. And when that position became vacant, I joined the staff of Melody Maker, staff writer. And as you point out, yeah, squatted on that. To the utter disgust, I'm sure, of like the likes of Pricey and Taylor. Another decade.
It's startling how pop all of this is. Considering that Melody Maker, I don't know, like a matter of 4 years before, would have had, like, I don't know, fucking Uriah Heep on the cover or something. It's a real change around.
In the gig guide, Well, David could have seen the Damned at the Marquee, Iggy Pop at the Venue, Elton John at Hammersmith Odeon, Kajagoogoo at the Brixton Ace, Shack Attack at Wembley Conference Centre, Twisted Sister at the Marquee, or Jabba at the Stockwell Plough. But probably didn't.
Indeed not.
Taylor could have seen Southern Death Cult at the Birmingham Gold Eagle, Dire Straits at the NEC, the Meteors at the Powerhouse, or Slade at Birmingham Odeon. Neil could have seen Poison Girls at the Coventry General Wolf and fuck all else. Sarah could have seen Ozzy Osbourne at Leeds Queen Hall, Killing Joke at the Leeds Warehouse, Robert Plant at the Warehouse, Blancmange at the Sheffield Lyceum, or Show Waddy Waddy at the Scarborough Futurist. Al could have seen Thomas Dolby at the Asylum, Echo and the Bunnymen at Rock City, or gone to Derby to see Simple Minds at the Assembly Rooms, or De Montfort Hall in Leicester for Whitesnake, or nipped over to Loughborough to see the Kinks. And Simon could have seen Cliff Richard at Cardiff St David's Hall, possibly with the Gummy Woman. In the letters page, Miss MJ Beeson, headmistress of Copleston High School, Ipswich, writes to Carol Clark regarding her recent interview with the Addicts, pointing out that the Zimbabwe chant on their new LP, Sound of Music, was not written by original frontman Niall Corr, as he claimed. Whilst waiting outside the huts to go into lessons, a large group of 13-year-olds developed the chant under the leadership of another lad. Niall was just one of the crowd of bystanders. Sorry, Niall, you borrowed it, and we don't mind in the least bit. As the Romans said, let justice reign, though the skies fall. Oh, imagine being shown up by one of your old teachers. Your paper has been reported as suffering a severe drop in sales recently, says Terence R. Ball of Accrington, and a likely contributing factor springs to mind. You hardly, if at all, cater for those of us out there who are over 16. A very large number of artists from the 60s and 70s are still working live and on record, and very successfully too. Ever seen an empty seat at a Shadows gig, for instance? Not your scene.
Yeah. Not catering for artists from the 60s and 70s. I don't suppose Mojo and Uncut get many letters like that these days.
No.
Yeah.
And all the other letters are too boring to read out, so I won't bother. So there we go. 80 pages, 70p. I never knew there was so much in it. So what else was on telly this day? Well, BBC One kicks off at 20 past nine with Bugs Bunny's Loony Christmas Tales, where Yosemite Sam, Porky Pig and Tweety Pie reenact a Christmas carol. Then after a quick blast of the Womble, Cheryl Campbell, Roger Daltrey's Mrs. and McVicar, reads Hans Christian Andersen's The Snow Queen in Jackanory. After Why Don't You, it's Battle of the Planets, Play Chess, and then the 1945 Johnny Weissmuller film Tarzan and the Amazons. Isn't that a completely different continent?
It is, yeah, it is actually.
He might as well have a go at the fucking Eskimos while he's at it.
How does Tarzan get there?
Oh, a very long rope and a very tall tree. After the short Leon Errol film Beware of Redheads, it's News Afternoon with Richard Whitmore, Regional News in Your Area, Pebble Mill at 1, and Chigley. At 5 past 2, it's the 1948 adaptation of Anna Karina starring Vivian Lee. Then it's Regional News in Your Area, Play School, Mighty Mouse, Jeremy Irons reading The Small Miracle by Paul Gallico in Jackanory, the final part of Huckleberry Finn and his friends, Blue Peter, then Paddington, the evening news with Richard Baker, regional news in your area again, nationwide, including the final of the nationwide carol competition live from Norwich Cathedral, and they've just finished Tomorrow's World, where Maggie Philbin, Peter McCann, Kieran Prendeville and Judith Han find out how dangerous the seasonings are in your Christmas dinner.
I know that. I mean, it's 1982, not fucking very, I would imagine. An excess of parsley and the sauce, perhaps. Source of cancer?
Oh, it's thrillingly 1982, though. I noticed Battle of the Planets there, my God.
Of course.
I mean, my daughter curses me at the moment because last week I introduced her to the theme to Battle of the Planets, the theme to Jason and the Wheel Warriors, but most earwormy of all, the theme to Ulysses 31. You know, one of the greats.
BBC Two commences at 11 with Play School and then closes down for 2.5 hours. At 2 p.m, it's International Cycling from Goodwood, followed by Robert Birchfield, editor-in-chief of the Oxford English Dictionary, in conversation with Bernard Levin in the Levin interviews. This is Christmas, for fuck's sake. We're all sitting at home, needing to be entertained, and they give us this.
I disagree. It was great sometimes when you used to get things like Ken Burns' The Civil War and stuff like that, doing that Christmas prude at about 11.
Yeah, but this ain't Ken Burns' The Civil War, is it?
No, it's Bernard Levin. But
so it's someone who runs a dictionary having a chat.
Yeah.
You know, kids and parents to inherently mistrust those kids who actually look forward to the Royal Society Christmas lectures.
Oh,
yes.
But they were no help with the vaccine, were they?
After that, it's Arthur Negus Enjoys, which features him looking at some ceramics in Temple Newsom. That's followed by part three of the Michael Bryant adaptation of A Christmas Carol. And at 4:05, it's the 1959 Peter Sellers film Carlton Brown of the F.O. Then the short film Wings and Things about model aircraft. Then the natural history quiz show What on Earth? The Jeremy Beadle and Clive Doig invention show Eureka. The news. And they're about 25 minutes into the Charles Laughton version of Mutiny on the Bounty. ITV start the day at 9:30 with Sesame Street, then Truman Capote's reminiscences of growing up in small-town America in A Christmas Memory, then Mick Robinson makes up some exotic cocktails and party favours in the Free Time Christmas Show. After Ark Stories, it's Get Up and Go. Sefton, A Household Name, a documentary about the horse that survived the Hyde Park bombing. The News at 1, regional news in your area. House Calls, a documentary about three youths studying at the Royal Ballet Lower School called I Really Want to Dance. Johnny Mathis Sings Christmas. Take the High Road. The Harlem Globetrotters meet Snow White. A Christmas Carol concert from the Free Trade Hall in Manchester. Then the news at 5:45 and regional news in your area. Kevin and Glenda have misgivings about their new lodger in Crossroads. Not much happens in Emmerdale Farm. And they're 10 minutes into the remake of The Lady Vanishes, starring Elliot Gould, Sybil Shepherd and Arthur Lowe. Channel 4 is still not bothering to run anything in the day, waiting until 4:45 to get going with the 1922 Buster Keaton film My Wife's Relations. After Cartoon World, David Wilkie shows us how to do the backstroke without smashing your head into the side of the pool in Splash. Then Judge Wapner returns for another episode of People's Court. At 6:30, it's How to Succeed with Sand, which looks at new technologies in the world of granular material and the issues raised by it. And they're currently midway through Channel 4 News. Oh, How to Succeed with Sand. Good old Channel 4.
Jesus. It's not exactly festive fare, is it?
But, you know, overall, you could plot a pretty decent, you know, if you skip from channel to channel, give Bernard Levin a swerve and perhaps the Harlem Globetrotters meeting Snow White, and you've got a pretty decent...
Yeah, you want that. That's the fucking highlight of the day, as far as I can see.
Yeah, you would lap it up, but you know, you're not too bad. You got your Bugs Bunny, you got Laurel and Hardy, you got the very last ever silent film, which is an odd thing, you know, they have it on ITV. You got Buster Keaton, Carlton Brown of the F.O. And that remake of Lady Vanishes isn't too bad. It's got Arthur Lowe in it. I've seen that before. You know, and this is one of the things when I wrote the book is that, of course, even back in 1982, you know, you're sort of sitting scrolling around the four channels of a day and you'll collide with stuff like Buster Keaton, Laurel and Hardy. But, you know, that was then, and that was, you know, what my generation, people younger than me, grew up with. But, I mean, like Alicia, you know, my daughter or whatever, today, I mean, she'll never collide with those things. And there's this whole vast tranche of, like, history of comedy that is just going unwatched. Laurel and Hardy haven't been on telly since 2004, not mainstream telly. So, yeah, I've a real pang of nostalgia. nostalgia, actually. A genuine wistfulness on this occasion, yeah.
You need that kind of mix of boredom and a dearth of channels to stumble across stuff like
totally.
That.
Totally. Yeah.
Which just doesn't exist anymore. But I have to admit, it's not exactly festive fare across those four channels, is it? I mean, it's the day before Christmas.
Yes.
You know, I'd be getting tremendously excited, but I wouldn't be finding that mirrored on the telly at all.
I need to know what happens in Snow White meets the Harlem Globetrotters.
Yeah, fair enough, fair enough.
How does it get resolved?
Mm. I mean, I presume the Globetrotters are the dwarves kind of characters, perhaps.
I've no idea.
And if they're the dwarves, Snow White must be fucking enormous.
Yes. Exactly, yeah. And what happens at the end? Do the Harlem Globetrotters climb up a ladder and like slam dunk an apple into the witch's mouth or whatever happens in that?
Yeah. I like the sound of the People's Court. I don't remember it, but it's obviously precursor to Judge Judy. I think that could have been.
Oh yeah. It was. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was one of the things that I was really excited about when Channel 4 started up. Let's bear in mind, Channel 4's only been going for about 7 weeks or so. If that.
Mm.
So, yeah, and People's Court was one of the things that was like, oh, look at those crazy Americans. This is what they do. And we could watch it on our telly.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
Channel 4, they started doing the Gong Show as well, which was fucking brilliant. Mm. Yeah. Hated the British version of it.
Yeah.
Not even Frankie Howard could make a go of it. Nah. But it did give us that amazing bit of footage of Tony Blackburn dressed as Superman singing Land of Hope and Glory while roller skating and falling on his arse and disappointing Barbara Windsor again. All right, and Pop Craze Youngsters, I do believe that we peeled off the flimsy plastic covering of the selection box we're about to tuck into, so we're going to leave it there and we're going to come back tomorrow and get stuck into this episode of Top of the Pops. So, my name's Al Needham, that's Neil Kulkarni.
Cheers, Al.
And there's David Stubbs.
Yeah, we both.
And we'll be right back here this time tomorrow. So sit tight, listen keenly, stay pop crazed.
Chart music.
GreatBigOwl.com.
My mate bought a toaster. We go through celebrities' Amazon purchase histories so you don't have to. Keep calm and love Dom Jolly novelty keyring and fridge magnets.
Yeah, I love that.
The G-spot.
The good vibrations, guys.
Green dot laser sight rifle gun scope.
I've bought that quite a lot of times, I think.
Right, okay. The sex doctor's guide to keeping it hot.
Ah, interesting.
Did another child come along 9 months later?
Yeah.
Loads of great eps up now, and new ones dropping every Monday. That's My Mate Bought a Toaster from Great Big Al.